Do you guys have anyone in your family that leaves a trail? Like you can tell where a certain person has been. Like our family, we're not necessarily like neatniks. Like everything's not neat and ordered. I certainly am not that way. But there's one member of our family, especially our youngest, Nora, who's the smallest among us, yet you can always tell wherever Nora has been. Like, because she has this amazing ability to engage everything around her and somehow turn it into her own project or her own, you know, make-believe. And so, like, she just has this way to pass through a room just to, like, go get her toothbrush, and she'll get involved in, like, three activities along the way. And you can see the remnants of that. She leaves a wake of her creativity. You walk through the house that was clean an hour ago, and you see, like, the stuffed animal set up in a school, you know, play school setting. You have letters written to her cousin. You have some drawings over here. You have an art project that she's created. And there's stuff everywhere. She leaves a wake where she takes things, changes them in some way, and it becomes part of her story. And it's actually, sometimes it's a little overwhelming, yet I love that about her, that she engages everything, and she's so creative. Do you guys have someone in your family like that? Maybe. You can always tell where they've been. Some of you are looking at other people that you live with. One of the things that I love about Jesus is that, like Nora, he left a wake and a trail where he went. Didn't he? Like when Jesus went through his life and ministry, he did not leave places the same. He changed the landscape. He changed lives. He changed people. And instead of, you know, kind of disarray and make-believe setups, Jesus changed things by leaving a wake and a trail of changed lives, of restored people, of wholeness, of peace. And basically, Jesus, as he lived his life, kind of undid the effects of the fall, which happened in Genesis chapter 3. He undid those things. And one of my favorite sections of Scripture in all of the Bible is where our red letter question is today. And at first glance, it doesn't sound like a very provocative question, but I think it actually is. And this happens in Mark chapter 5. If you have a Bible, open up there. It's not going to be on the screen, so you're either going to have to listen well or open up your Bible and read along with me. But this is in Mark chapter 5, starting in verse 21, is where we're going to be with this red letter question. And let me tell you what happened just before this. At the end of chapter 4 is when Jesus calms a storm. He's with his disciples on a boat. They all think they're going to die. He stands up. Matt preached on this text, not from Mark, right? Did you do Mark? From Luke. About Jesus calming the storm. He calms the storm, and it makes the disciples terrified because Jesus, with the word, calms the storm. Then they land on the other side of the lake in the Gentile region, where they meet in the tombs a demon-possessed man possessed by a legion of demons. With the word, Jesus heals this man. A beautiful story. Restores him. And then goes back, and as soon as they land, this takes place on the other side of the lake. So Jesus has done some amazing things, and sometimes when faith is challenging for me, like when my faith is fleeting or difficult to hold on to, there is nothing that is better for my faith than reading the Gospels and reading about Jesus and reading about the way he changed lives. And this section, this few hours of Jesus' life is one of my favorites. And we're going to meet someone who Jesus asked a question to that I think is very powerful. And we get a good picture of who Jesus is. So let's read together. Mark chapter 5, 21 through 34. And this is, again, right after two amazing miracles and some great teaching by Jesus. It says this. When Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. Then one of the synagogue rulers, named Jairus, came there. Seeing Jesus, he fell at his feet and pleaded earnestly with him, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live." So Jesus went with him. A large crowd followed and pressed around him. And a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had. Yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak, because she thought, "If I just touch his clothes, I will be healed." Immediately, her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. At once, Jesus realized that power had gone out from him. He turned around in the crowd and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" "You see the people crowding against you," his disciples answered, "and yet you can ask who touched me?" But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet, and trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." So cool. So cool. And here's why. We'll talk about why. I love this passage about Jesus undoing brokenness and hurt and suffering and just being awesome. And I want to talk about three things from this story this morning as we think about this question. The first is I want us to talk about the woman. And then I want to talk about Jesus. And then I want to talk about faith, which is an important element to this story, this pericope that we're looking at this morning. So Mark doesn't tell us much about this woman. We don't know her name. Mark gives very few names in the Bible, but of people that Jesus meets. Jairus is one of them. But this woman, we don't know much about her. We don't know her age, although she was probably at least in her mid-20s. We don't know her family status because of her condition. Very likely was either victim of divorce or maybe was unmarried. We don't know anything about her family. But she had some sort of chronic illness that was likely like a perpetual uterine bleeding that was plaguing her for 12 years, we're told, which ironically is the exact same age as Jairus' daughter, who Jesus is going to heal, who is going to help at the same time. Now, this is not her monthly cycle, which would have been a normal thing that women would have experienced, but this was perpetual. This was keeping her from living a full and normal life. And in Jewish culture at this time, this would have put her in a category of being someone who was ritually unclean, unable to be a part of public worship, unable to even touch people, to be unable to really be in relationships, to not be in contact with other people. And this comes from what we call the holiness code, which you can read a lot about in Leviticus and in the Torah in the Old Testament. When God called his people and he gave them the law and he spoke through Moses and he said, you know, "I, the Lord your God, am holy, and so you are to be a holy people." And they were to be a different type of people from those around them. And so God gave this long holiness code list of things that people needed to avoid in order to stay clean, to be holy. And you see all these, if you've ever read through the Bible, you start in Genesis, and it's kind of narrative, it makes sense, you know, it's kind of a story. You get into Exodus, there's more of that. Then you get into these weird laws, and then you get into Leviticus, and there's all these laws about like mildew, and blood, and dead animals, and certain foods, and open sores, and death, and unclean animals, and all these different things. And contact with some of these things would have made someone ritually unclean, unable to be a part of temple worship, or in Jesus' time, synagogue worship, or with other people. Now, it's important to notice, when we talk about uncleanliness, like in Leviticus, we're not talking about necessarily things that are inherently sinful, but really things that are part of normal human life that for a time would mark as someone as being unable to be a part of ceremonial worship. It barred people from entering the temple or being part of it. And I think this is part of the reason God gave the holiness code, is to remind people that your humanness makes you different from God. Like, we're invited into a relationship with him, but Jesus is not our homeboy, right? Like, God is not like our buddy. He's God. And the holiness code reminds us that our humanness is so different from him, that he is so far beyond us. But so this woman was dealing with an issue that made her perpetually unclean. And you can imagine how difficult that would have been for her, because in Jesus' day, not only was there the holiness code that was in the Torah, but the religious leaders had added on rules and rules and rules that made cleanliness a really, really big deal. And people often believed that physical maladies and illnesses were because God was punishing you. So a woman like this was seen as stricken by God. People would have kind of turned up their noses at her. She would have been an outcast. She would have been an outsider. And she would have been treated poorly. It was already a hard enough time to be a woman. But this was especially difficult for this woman. And she's desperate. We know this. She's financially destitute. She's spent everything she's had. She's suffered. She's been separated. She's an outcast. And she is unable to really be in relationships, unable to even be close to people because of the purity codes, and even unable to be touched. Could you imagine not being able to touch people? And some of you are like, that sounds great. My least favorite part of church is when you make me shake someone's hand. That may be the case for you. However, you need physical touch. You need it. It's part of how God wired us to need that. Maybe you've heard of the horrible studies that have been done, one in 1944, where 42 newborn babies were put in a sterile environment, given comfort and everything they needed to survive as far as like food and sterile environments and warmth. Almost half of these newborns died. And almost all of them didn't continue to develop. They would disconnect. They were unhealthy. Without just the touch of a human being, these children suffered. Touch also has the ability to unlock more humanity in us. There was another study I read about 3 decades ago. But do you remember what you used to do whenever you walked by a payphone? You check the change, right? Like, and I always, when I was a kid, walking by a payphone, assumed I was going to get money. I never ever found quarters in there. But for some reason, like it's drilled into us. You're supposed to go by a payphone and look for change. Well, there was a study, I think it was out of Stanford, because they were doing all the studies at the time, but they put $1.35 in change in the coin return slot of a payphone and watched people walk by, and people would check it, and they'd find the money, and they'd put it in their pocket. When the people would walk down the street, somebody would stand at a distance and say, "Hey, did you happen to find any money in that payphone?" And over 90% of the people said, "Nope, didn't see anything." They did the exact same experiment, same amount of money, $1.35, but they would go up to the person and they'd put an arm on their shoulder and say, "Hey, did you find any money in that payphone?" And with a touch on the shoulder or some sort of physical initiation, over 90% of the respondents said, "Yes, I did. Is it yours? Here you go." Total change in human behavior because of a simple touch. Just this week, I met with a woman. We get a lot of phone calls from people looking for financial help in the community. And so we spend a lot of time just meeting with people that, you know, their challenges, difficulties, and they're looking for help. And sometimes it's a Safeway gift card we do. Sometimes it's more than that. But a woman came by, and we talked for a while, and just a really challenging season of life for her. And she was facing foreclosure, and she was about to have her electricity shut off. So we prayed with her, and we were able to paid for her power bill for the time being, and gave her some Safeway gift cards, and talked about Jesus and for a bit. And I prayed with her, but I'm always, whenever I meet strangers, I always never want to be too. I want to be wise, you know, and careful, and not pushy or anything like that. But we did this, and we prayed together, and she was just crying. She says, "Pastor Mark, can I please have a hug?" And I said, "I'm sorry. No, I don't feel comfortable." No, of course. But in that situation, yes, of course, you do what love does in that situation. And it was to give this woman a hug. And she just kind of melted. Like I think that meant more to her than the other things that we did in that moment. But this woman, you can imagine, unable to be in a relationship, unable to be touched, financially just broke. She is absolutely desperate. Just like Jairus was about his daughter. She was desperate for something. She says, "This is my chance." She spent all her money. She has heard that Jesus heals people. Elsewhere in Mark, we're told that people who touched Jesus were healed. She's like, "I want in on that." So she risks it all, goes into the crowd. She reaches out and just touches his clothes, touches his cloak. Now remember, Jesus is on a mission of life and death right here, right? He lands on the boat. Jairus says, "Look, my daughter is about to die." Jairus is important. He's the synagogue ruler. He's studied. He's probably wealthy. He's respected. He's well-heeled. And Jesus is like, "Yeah, let's go." So he goes, and this crowd follows. He's going to save this girl. This is important. You know, this is like an ambulance rushing down to the emergency room, like heading out. And she reaches out and touches and stops in the middle of this important mission. And Jesus says, "Hey, who touched me? Who touched my clothes?" And his disciples are like, Jesus, like everybody is touching you right now. What are you even talking about?" And one thing we've learned in our youth group is that a lot of people can occupy a small spot if they're determined. We have this new tradition that started for a few years. of when we stop on the way to our summer camp rendezvous, we pack as many people as possible into a porta potty. We've been doing it for about 5 years, and every year it's grown how many? But that's 2017, 18, and 19. And so there's, in this picture, I don't know how many are in that one, there's 27 in that picture. And there's 29 there. Now, I know technically, like, Rose is only halfway in, like, but she's closer. I think next year, to really beat it, we're going to have to, like, do double-decker and put people on top of people's heads. But it's like, I mean, just imagine if in this little room, if William back here says, "Hey, who touched me?" Like, seriously. Everybody is, right? Everybody is. But this is what's happening. The crowds are all around Jesus. He stops and says, "Who touched me?" And this woman's fears are realized. She's like, she took a risk. She did a big no-no because she's unclean, remember? And she touched a rabbi, generally frowned upon, okay? She does it anyway. And she stops and Jesus is like, "Whoa, hold on, someone touched me." She's like, he's talking about me. He's talking about me. So what does Mark tell us happens is she falls down in fear. She knows she's been healed. She knows she's caught. She falls down in fear. And at first glance, I think it sounds like she's afraid Jesus is going to ream her, right? She's probably used to this. How dare you? You can't bring unclean. What are you doing, lady? It sounds like she's kind of afraid of that. However, I don't think that's why she's afraid, because of how fear looks in the rest of the Gospel of Mark. You remember how we talked about how Jesus calmed the storm? What happened as soon as Jesus calmed the storm and the physical dangers of the storm went away? The disciples were terrified, right? Right after that, they land in the Gerasenes where Jesus healed the demoniac. And the demons first are freaked out by Jesus' presence. He makes them go away and destroys a bunch of pigs. And then the townspeople come up and they see crazy demon guy sitting in his right mind and clothed. And what does it say the townspeople said about him? They were terrified. They were freaked out. So over and over again, when people see the power of Jesus in the Gospels, especially in Mark, there's this reverent fear. Like, whoa, we are not dealing with a normal human being here. There's something very, very special about Jesus. He has power. And the same thing for us. When we recognize and we see Jesus' power in our lives, and there's nothing greater he'll ever do for us than rescue us from sin and to call us his children. When we fall, the response is to fall on our knees and be like, "Whoa, I'm kind of terrified of you, Jesus. I'm in awe, and you are incredible. And wow, what can we do but fall before him because he's so awesome?" And so this leads us then to focus on Jesus. We talked about the woman a little bit, but let's talk about Jesus, the star of this story. Because Jesus is compassionate, he's interruptible, he's transforming, and he's on his way to rescue this little girl who's 12 years old and is dying along the way. And remember, in Jewish purity culture, uncleanliness always passed from what was unclean to what is clean. So like if you are ceremonially unclean and I'm clean and I touch you, guess who's unclean for 1 to 7 days? Both of us. And so over and over again that happens. However, what happens with Jesus here? Someone who is unclean touches Jesus, and because he's Jesus, instead of her uncleanliness going to him, his cleanliness goes to her. This is so cool. This is so, so rad. And this happens all over the place in the Gospels, even in Mark, just in the little bit we've talked about. If you go back to Mark chapter 1, Jesus meets a leper. Lepers are ceremonially unclean because of their open sores and who they are. Jesus touches the leper, another big no-no, and instead of becoming unclean, the guy is restored. That's awesome. Just before, we talked about the Gerasenes. Jesus lands in a tomb. Jews are not supposed to go to Gentile tombs. Like, but he goes in there, and instead of becoming unclean, his cleanliness gets passed on to this man. Jesus is touched by this woman with a hemorrhage, and instead of becoming unclean, she is healed. And then just after this, he's going to the house of a dead girl. Jairus' daughter, we're told, if you read the rest of it, they come up while this is happening and say, "Hey, don't bother the teacher anymore. Don't make him become unclean by coming to the house. She already died. It's too late." And Jesus says to Jairus, "Just believe." And he enters a house of a dead person, and instead of becoming unclean, this little girl is restored to life. This is so cool. This is so cool. This is amazing. This is the God that we worship. This is the one that we worship, that his holiness flows to what is unclean, to us, to what is impure. to what is broken, to what is messed up, and it flows into that and fix it. And see, nothing that keeps you from God is any match for Jesus' grace and power. So your sin, your shame, your failure, your fears, your uncleanliness, everything that keeps you from God is no match for Jesus' grace, mercy, and power. Okay? I can say it again. You write it down, maybe. It's good. This is tweetable. So here's your sin, your shame, your failure, your fears, your uncleanliness, everything that might keep you from God is no match for Jesus' grace, mercy, and power. That's really good news for this woman and also for us. And when it's passed on to us, his holiness comes upon us and we're seen as righteous because of Jesus, the response is like this woman. We fall to our knees and be like, whoa, thank you, Jesus. Whoa. That's amazing. That's awesome. And so Jesus has this transaction of giving her wholeness. And yet it's not just transactional. This is a personal interchange. This is a personal thing. Now Jesus was healed by this woman. He knew it. He could have kept walking. Maybe said to Peter later on, hey, I just healed a woman back there. I mean, or just kept it to himself. He could have done that. This woman could have left healed, full, restored. But instead he stops and he says, who touched my clothes? Who touched me? Now, do we think that Jesus doesn't know? I think he knows what's up. I mean, he's pretty smart, right? And he's a little more intuitive than the rest of us. But she owns it. She falls down before him and he says, calls her what? Daughter. He says, daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace. Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace. Imagine what this was like for her. First, the fear and the courage of going to touch Jesus. Then the terror of being caught and found out. And then the full restoration of Jesus saying, daughter, you're healed. Go in peace.